This episode of Mile Higher is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with Auto Quote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to The Wealth Break.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone. It's not just about saving, it's about investing. It's about navigating systems that weren't built for you, embracing your hustle, and relying on your community to create something bigger.
And that's exactly why we created The Wealth Break. We made something different, something more human. It's not just another financial podcast. It's a conversation about real life, real struggles, and real wins.
We're here to talk about the journey. You're hearing from people who've broken barriers, found creative ways to succeed, and learn to build wealth on their terms. Whether it's the first-time homeowner, a gig worker, or someone turning a side hustle into a six-figure business, we're bringing you their stories.
And we're not stopping at success stories. We're breaking down the realities, like what it means to take risk, how to navigate failure, and why resilience matters. Because wealth isn't about money. It's about creating a life where you can thrive and help others to do the same.
So if you're ready for a podcast as much as about people as it is about money, you're in the right place.
Listen to The Wealth Break podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
Hey, what is up, everybody?
And welcome back to episode of...
Oh, who knows what the fuck show this is today?
Mile Higher Podcast, episode 323. Sorry, I'm a little rusty. I haven't been here.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I just missed last week, but...
Well, and we were off last week, so it's been 2 weeks.
Yes. Guys, we're sorry. It's been a little... chaotic. We had this giant blizzard here. Colorado.
Illness.
We are here today, and I'm pumped to be back. And I'm really pumped about today's episode because we are finally looking at the
300 episodes later.
Yeah.
Covering one of the most infamous unsolved mysteries of the human age.
Mm-hmm. And one of, I think, our most requested episodes. And I really don't know why we haven't gone into it before. I think, to be honest, I kind of always judged it because it's older and I thought it was maybe boring, but I was very wrong. I have really enjoyed learning about Mr. D.B. Cooper, and I'm fascinated by the mystery.
The only unsolved skyjacking in U.S. history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What happened to Mr. D.B. Cooper?
We may never know.
Oh, I know exactly what happened.
Do you?
Mm-hmm. I have inside knowledge.
Oh, okay. You're going to share that with us?
Maybe.
Maybe we'd be the one to finally crack this bitch open.
Yep. It's exactly what you all thought. Surprise. Mm. No, actually, there's a lot of different theories. And I have a unique theory that I will be proposing that I don't think has been put out there yet.
Mm, we love that.
Is it plausible? Depends on who you are.
Hey, I mean.
But you know me.
The whole story is like implausible, but actually happened. We were just talking about how it seems like a cartoon. Like it's almost feels made up.
Tom, has there been a movie on this? First of all, Tom and Ian are here today.
Yep.
Forgot to introduce our lovely production folks over here.
Yep. Okay. Ian, our producer. Tom also edits the show and produces it as well. And we always love having you on, so thanks for joining us. Janelle's actually at a conference today, so she couldn't join us.
She's over at Spotify today.
Yeah. Yep.
Seeing Halsey.
Halsey live, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're here, so... Yeah.
But anyway, back to Tom.
That's code for I'm slowly replacing Janelle on the show.
Yeah, exactly. Don't tell Janelle.
I mean, there's tons of documentaries, but there's like one movie I know off the top of my head called The Pursuit of D.B. Cooper. It's like an actual drama movie.
My dad was telling me about it.
But not necessarily directly connected to it, but the main character of Twin Peaks was inspired by D.B. Cooper for David Lynch.
So
if you want to make that connection, there's that, which... Love Twin Peaks, so.
What did you think of the movie?
It's okay. Like Josh, have you ever seen like Fire in the Sky?
Yeah. It's kind of like
same
that
kind of vibe.
Okay.
Yeah, where it's like so. Half of it is really good, and the other half of it is like, can we?
What is this?
Move along? Yeah.
Well, it's from 81, So it's yeah, it's 10 years time. After this happened.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised there hasn't been like a Tom Cruise D.B. Cooper movie.
No, they really should
Seems
make
Seems like
one.
He'd be the guy to jump from the airplane.
Mr. Cruise is too handsome.
Does his own stunts. Yeah, true. Yeah.
Two hands. I love him.
But I could see Hollywood doing that. Get a really, really attractive, handsome D.B. Cooper.
Mm-hmm. Glenn Powell.
Yeah. I mean, they technically referenced it in Mad Men and Loki.
Oh,
they
yeah.
They did reference it in Mad Men.
Yeah.
And I remember it in Loki. I've never seen Mad Men.
Oh, man. It's so good.
It's the greatest.
Yeah, we started it.
Oh, yeah, we did start it. Yeah, why did we bail?
It's John Hamm, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Just same reason we always bail on stuff. Like after the first episode.
Zero attention span.
Yeah. If it's not like intense and like gripping and, you know, we're like grabbing the edges of our bed, like, oh, this is crazy. Then we turn it off. But
yeah, we just gave up on Ted Lasso after. What did you think of that show?
You know, it's a little
mid.
It's the first two seasons I liked, and then I was like, well, look at this. It's bullshit now.
Yeah.
It's fucking bullshit.
Yeah. Just got progressively worse.
Mm-hmm.
I love Jason Sudeikis, but I don't know if I can continue. Yeah.
He wears, fun fact, all of the sneakers he wears is from his own personal collection. He's a big
You would know that.
Yes, really? He's a bit of a sneakerhead. He's a big Jordan guy.
Definitely would know that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, maybe we'll give it a shot.
But anyways.
TV time.
Sorry for the tangent. But yeah, D.B. Cooper, man. What a mystery.
Fascinating
fella. And honestly, he did commit a hijacking, but he was pretty polite about it.
He'd probably still be in prison right now.
Yep.
If he had been caught, but he wasn't. The FBI could not solve this one.
And it's possible it's because he is dead.
Possibly.
Or it's possible that he's... As many think, people think he's out in Mexico living his best life, sipping margaritas on the beach. No one really knows.
Yeah, possibly.
But it's the legend. And yeah, it's way more fascinating than I realized. I truly enjoyed prepping for this episode. So
here is the story of D.B. Cooper.
Mm-hmm. So to get into the story, we have to picture ourselves back in 1971. And things were very different, especially when it comes to air travel. Okay, so it brings us to November 24th, 1971, and it was a routine, busy day at the Portland International Airport. And because it was Thanksgiving Day, hundreds of passengers made their way through the airport, many purchasing tickets right at the counter, which does anyone do that anymore? Walk up to the counter and purchase a ticket?
Don't know.
It's got to be so rare.
I'm sure it happens still, but I'm sure it's a rarity at this point. Most people are doing it online, or now they have the kiosk. I don't even need to talk to a human at this point.
Yep.
I actually have a friend of mine who he was telling me how like he makes really good money, and he's like, yeah, I just buy my tickets at the counter just to flex on people.
Wow.
It's more expensive.
That's
big man moves.
This is only recent.
In cash, cold hard cash, briefcase.
But yeah, a lot of these people, you know, were hoping to make it home in time for the holiday. It's the chaotic time to travel for Thanksgiving. And back then, it was a little less chaotic, the travel experience, but six crew members of the Northwest Orient Flight 305 boarded the Boeing 727-100 for a 30-minute flight, quick little flight, to the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. And flight attendants Alice Hancock, Tina Mucklow, and Florence Schaffner cleaned the cabin, set out the ashtrays, and prepared drinks for the passengers boarding the plane.
They had the flight attendants doing the cleaning, man.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of fucked up.
It is.
Yeah, like, it's very different.
But also they were drinking and they were smoking.
Yeah. It's true. It's kind of a fun time. I wonder if they let the flight attendants drink and smoke.
I feel like it's bartender rules. I feel like, you know, they could
slip a little drink.
A little nip.
I'm sure they did. Yeah. A little ciggy in the back.
Oh, big time.
They're like looking at through like cigarette butts, see if one's still lit.
Can you imagine the air quality being in a metal tube with all that cigarette smoke?
That
has nowhere to go.
Really nice.
You would.
Is it just me though? Like cigarette smoke kind of low key smells good.
No, I actually agree. Like, it depends.
Not like heavy, but just Vegas casinos. I actually kind of like the air smell.
Especially if it's like menthol. It doesn't bother me as much.
Nah,
I don't know.
Just give me the straight Marlboros.
But you know what? Cigarette breath, though, big no. cannot do.
That's where I draw the line.
Mm-hmm. You have a big...
No cigarette breath. That is a fear, deep fear of mine. Cigarette breath.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
You had a bad experience with that long ago.
Yes, I did.
But anyway, shortly before the scheduled departure time of 2:50 p.m., a man wearing a black business suit, a white shirt, a thin black tie fitted with a mother-of-pearl tie pin, a black raincoat, and brown loafers purchased a one-way ticket for $20. Absolutely insane, which is the equivalent of $155 in today's currency.
So but, like a Spirit Airlines ticket.
Yeah, especially for a 30-minute flight. I guess it's not that far off, but
no.
Just crazy to think about $20.
Well, and because we're going to be talking about money quite a bit in this episode, to give you a good reference, because I think house price is like a good reference for a lot of people, it was $28,000 for a home in 1971. That was like the average median price.
Wow.
$28,000. I think my grandparents bought their house for like 10 grand.
And they still live in it.
In the 50s, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they still live in it.
Crazy.
Man, the equity they built in that house.
Oh, damn.
Crazy. It's a tiny house, but it's worth like $500,000 now, and they paid $10,000 for it.
That's so wild.
Yeah, crazy. I was also going to say, too, when I first heard the description of D.B. Cooper, my mind immediately went to, what if he is one of the Men in Black? Some type of secret agent. But
interesting theory.
That kind of got busted when I figured out he was wearing brown loafers.
Yeah, they wouldn't have done that. Because
there's not a Men in Black wearing brown loafers. That just immediately kills the cool, right?
Yeah.
You know, a little color differential. Yeah.
That's like, but the rule, right? It's got to be black and brown. It's not always practical. Tells me that.
It's not practical for a special agent to be wearing loafers.
I mean, he's also fucking around with the tie pin. I mean,
yeah, true. It is fire. It's kind of a flex, honestly.
Mother of Pearl, we love it.
Which is odd, especially with what happens, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Seems to be kind of decked out here.
Yeah.
We've all heard the stories, missing persons, double lives, suspicious basements, but here's one mystery you don't need in your life. Why can't my kid learn to ride a bike? For a lot of families, it turns into a saga. Meltdowns in the driveway, scraped knees, and frustrated parents Googling how to teach a kid to ride a bike without losing your mind. Well, that's where Guardian Bikes comes in. Their bikes are lightweight, low to the ground, and built to help kids find their balance fast. Most are riding confidently in just one day. No training wheels, no tears, just high fives and I did it moments. It's everything learning to ride should be. Simple, smooth, and actually fun. So skip the struggle and start with a bike that's made to make it easy. Go to guardianbikes.com. You'll save hundreds when comparing Guardian to its competitors. Plus, get a free bike lock and pump, a $50 value with your first purchase when you join their newsletter. That's guardianbikes.com.
So this man only carried a briefcase and a brown paper bag with him. And without even checking ID, because air travel was fucking wild back then, the man listed his name as Dan Cooper and boarded the plane. He took a seat in 18E, which was the last row, and he ordered up a nice bourbon and 7-Up from flight attendant Florence Schaffner before he lit a Raleigh cigarette. Florence sat in the jump seat directly behind Cooper as the plane took off from the runway on time. And shortly after the plane was airborne, Cooper turned to Florence and handed her a note. Now, Florence was an attractive 22-year-old woman. She, you know, was used to lonely businessmen flirting with her on flights. And so she assumed that the note was just probably his phone number. So she didn't even look at it. She slipped it into her purse and just stayed seated in the jump seat. But then after a few moments, Cooper turned around to her and spoke into her ear in a very calm and polite whisper. He said, "Miss, you'd better look at that note. I have a bomb." And what followed would turn into one of the most infamous unsolved crimes of all time and the only unsolved skyjacking in American history. But before we continue with the story of D.B. Cooper, let's provide some context as for air travel in the 1960s and 70s and explain why Cooper's case remains the most well-known.
Yeah, I think it would be difficult for us in this day and age to even wrap our heads around air travel in the 60s and 70s because it's way different. I mean, we've got TSA, metal detectors. Now we have machines that can like see through your entire body, strip searches,
no
and
smoking.
Dogs and, Yeah. I mean, you name it, they have it. Cameras everywhere. And so, and oftentimes it takes like 2 hours to go through security these days. Ugh,
nightmare. But I'm grateful for it. I'm very grateful.
Totally. I mean, to be able to walk into an airport, not produce an ID and just get a plane ticket and board, that is
with
like,
anything you want.
Yeah, anything you want. Which makes you wonder how much illegal shit went through airports during this time.
Oh, tons. A lot.
Tons and tons and tons.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's crazy. But this whole idea behind air travel at the time was they wanted it to be luxurious, comfortable, and of course, sexy, right?
And also unsafe.
Unsafe, but you're not going to care about that because you're going to be so comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so enamored with the sexy flight attendants.
Yeah, that's a really wild scene.
Yeah, well, of
that's
course, how it was of course they had to bring in the sex appeal. Because
mm-hmm.
that was their whole shtick, was that, you know, air travel was sexy. Flight attendants were flirtatious and sexually available. Marketers wanted to appeal to the lonely businessman, wealthy, busy, and loveless. These early advertisements wanted to make the airplane seem like a Playboy mansion party. Drink, smoke cigarettes, and flirt with the young stewardesses on board. Of course, the reality was far less glamorous. Sure, you could drink to your heart's content and even smoke a pack of cigarettes if you wanted. But like Florence, most of these flirtations were completely unwanted. Most flight attendants worked long hours, hundreds of miles away from their homes. They were tired and they're locked in a metal tube with drunk people. And they mainly just hoped for an uneventful flight. And that's because, as previously mentioned, security was non-existent at the airports during this time. And because of this, there was a ton of hijackings going on. This is kind of interesting. So the history of airline hijackings is kind of really intriguing because from the time that air travel started all the way up until 1968, There was definitely hijackings that were happening, but it didn't happen at the rate that they did from 1968 to 1972. So we're talking about 1971 with DB Cooper. They actually call this the golden age of hijackings because there were so many, 305 hijackings globally. And
so pretty much
before that, it would be like 10 incidents a year, you know, it wouldn't be that often. But for some reason, from 68 to 72, there was like this, you know, sharp rise, probably because somebody figured out it's not that hard to do and there's a way to get a payout.
Mm-hmm.
So it became a very popular crime. And between 1968 and 1972, there was more than 130 American flights that were hijacked, sometimes more than one on the same day. For the most part, these hijackings were bloodless. Some requested ransom money, some were going through a mental crisis, but many just wanted to go to Cuba. And this became so common that the phrase, quote, take me to Cuba, became a way to refer to hijackings in general.
Basically, bring me to Castro.
Mm-hmm. In 1970, after a Boeing 747 was hijacked and directed to Cuba, Castro himself greeted the plane and was given a tour by the pilots as he wanted to see one of the first passenger jumbo jets. But what's interesting is that even though American flights were being hijacked at an alarming rate, both air travel companies and the federal government even didn't want to do anything to prevent them. Because again, they had spent so many years and money marketing air travel as this comfortable, lavish, relaxing mode of travel that they worried customers would become upset if they installed security checkpoints or metal detectors at airports. And again, let's remember they weren't even checking IDs, which seems like at the very least,
yeah,
have them flash an ID and like, you know, maybe you don't check to see if it's a fake ID like they do now. They scan your IDs. But no, they were like,
they truly just did nothing.
Free and open air travel. And then the federal government came up with a ridiculous plan to create a fake version of Cuba's Havana airport in South Florida to fly hijackers to instead of actual security messages. They're like, oh, great solution. Let's just make a fake Havana airport that we'll take them to.
That is so, I can't believe that actually happened.
Yeah. So with all that in mind, it's very easy to see how Dan Cooper could have boarded flight 305 with a fake name and potentially a bomb, which he claims he had. But what's surprising is how he ultimately got away with it. I think that's the whole crazy mystery mm-hmm. of this story.
So when we left off in our story from earlier, Cooper had just told Florence that he had a bomb, and Florence reached into her purse and then opened the note. And although we can't be sure of the exact wording, which we will explain why later, it read, quote, "Miss, I have a bomb in my briefcase and I want you to sit by me." And Florence did what he said. She got up from the jump seat and sat in the aisle seat next to Cooper in the back row. She quietly asked to see the bomb, and then Cooper reached for his briefcase. And when he opened it, it revealed two rows of four sticks of dynamite attached to a battery with wires. And he made a motion that if two of the wires touched, bomb would, detonate.
Seems like a very sophisticated bomb he had going on there. I know. Oh, you just touched these two wires and...
Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of epic that his, like, ideal bomb was from, like, a Looney Tunes.
I was just about to say that, like, Roadrunner.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows if he was even legitimate.
Yeah.
No idea.
It could have been some candles, you know, painted red.
Some candles. Yeah, you never know.
I mean, I'm sure a lot of people, because it's like, I think if you're this, as we'll find out, if you're this smart and, you know, hatching this plan, if you actually got caught and then got caught with legitimate explosives, that's additional charges for you. But if you don't have, it's all fake decoy stuff, then you potentially don't get those charges.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So a lot of people would make fake weapons and stuff. It would also be
scary to carry around a bomb that was jimmy rigged like that.
Right.
So maybe he just was like, let me make a nice fake. I think there's a good chance it was fake.
If you don't know what you're looking at and this guy's...
Yeah. I'd believe him.
I mean, it's the same. It reminds me of my time working at the bank where they're like, there's a lot of robberies that take place where people bring in fake weapons or don't have weapons at all. And they pass you a note across the counter. It's like, I have a gun. Give me all the money in your drawer. And that you're not supposed to try to fight them. You're supposed to just give them the money.
Yep.
But I said, if that ever happens to me, I'm jumping over the counter. And we're fighting this out.
If only you were on flight 305. No, it wouldn't have gone down like
done.
This.
Done.
Wrestled it right out of his hands. Anyway, Cooper then told Florence his demands, which she wrote down on a piece of paper. He asked for $200,000, which was, he was open for negotiating on that because he said he wanted American currency, but if that wasn't available, he would settle for something else. And now $200,000 is equivalent to $1 million today. And he also wanted the plane to refuel once it landed at Seattle-Tacoma. And he wanted four parachutes as well. Now, that last point is important because requesting four parachutes might have indicated that Cooper wished to take hostages. And if Cooper had asked for just one, law enforcement would have likely just given him a dummy chute that wouldn't open. But with hostages as a possibility, they weren't going to take that risk. So Florence took the note to the cockpit and explained the situation to the flight crew. Captain William Scott contacted the airline's flight operation base in Minnesota, and Florence, who was obviously terrified of the situation, didn't want to go back and sit next to Cooper. So instead, attendant Tina Mucklow took her place next to Cooper and acted as his liaison with the flight crew. Now, once Tina sat down next to Cooper, he instructed how the money would be handed over to him. He said that all passengers would remain seated until Tina retrieved the cash, and once he had the money, the passengers could exit the plane, and at that point, he wished to receive the parachutes.
We've all heard the stories, missing persons, double lives, suspicious basements, but here's one mystery you don't need in your life. Why can't my kid learn to ride a bike? For a lot of families, it turns into a saga. Meltdowns in the driveway, scraped knees, and frustrated parents Googling how to teach a kid to ride a bike without losing your mind. Well, that's where Guardian Bikes comes in. Their bikes are lightweight, low to the ground, and built to help kids find their balance fast. Most are riding confidently in just one day. No training wheels, no tears, just high fives and I did it moments. It's everything learning to ride should be. Simple, smooth, and actually fun. So skip the struggle and start with a bike that's made to make it easy. Go to guardianbikes.com. You'll save hundreds when comparing Guardian to its competitors. Plus, get a free bike lock and pump of $50 value with your first purchase when you join their newsletter. That's guardianbikes.com. So Captain Scott relayed those demands to the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, and the Seattle Police Department and the FBI were immediately notified of the unfolding situation.
President of Northwest Airlines Donald Nyrup quickly authorized the $200,000 ransom and told the flight crew to comply with all of Cooper's demands. While those on the ground scrambled to gather up the cash, the parachutes, and the field trucks together, Captain Scott informed the passengers that due to a, quote, mechanical issue, their arrival to Seattle would be delayed. The plane circled the airport for an additional 2 hours. Imagine being on that flight, getting notified of a mechanical issue with the plane, yet we're going to circle in the air 2 hours directly above the airport. Remain calm, please.
That's so awesome.
But of course, I mean, I'm sure then they're like, all right, I'll smoke a few more cigarettes, have a few more drinks. Why not?
They know what they're doing.
Yeah, they're like, well, yeah, it's probably fine. We're good. While the plane circled in the air, Tina and Cooper carried on a pretty polite conversation. Cooper looked out the window and said, quote, looks like Tacoma down there, which indicated that he was familiar with the local terrain.
And I like the accent that randomly came out on that one.
Yeah, you never know. Never know where he's, we don't know where he's from. So maybe he's, you know, down south a bit there. Initially, the parachutes were going to be supplied by the McChord Air Force Base. However, they could only supply military parachutes, which, while sturdy, could not be steered while floating down. Instead, he was to receive civilian sports parachutes from a local skydiving school. However, Cooper correctly identified that McChord was only a 25-minute drive from the airport. Cooper asked Tina where she was from, and she said that she was raised in Pennsylvania but was currently living in Minnesota. Cooper said that Minnesota was, quote, very nice country, but refused to answer when Tina asked Cooper where he was from, because, of course, he doesn't want to give away where he's from. He's smart. He knows it. She's trying to figure out where he's from. Give it to the police. So he's like, no. Says, no, you're not going to know where I'm from. I mean, we don't know. Maybe he had an accent. Maybe he was trying to, like, throw people off. I never know.
That would be crazy if he went in there just with, like, a crazy-ass, like, Southern gentleman.
Which, of course, the flight attendants would have been like, yeah, he had a Southern accent. Yeah.
He sounded like Foghorn Leghorn.
Yeah. I think we can confirm that that was not the case.
Cooper then asked Tina if she'd like a cigarette, and she said that she had quit, but given the situation, hell, why not?
She's like, light me up, baby. Why not?
So she accepted one of Cooper's Raleigh cigarettes, and the two of them just smoked it up together. Tina said that Cooper was, quote, not nervous. He seemed rather nice, and he was not cruel or nasty. Cooper allegedly spoke to one man referred to as, quote, the cowboy by Tina and other passengers who witnessed the exchange, but aside from that, he only spoke to Tina and the flight crew. The passengers on board had no idea that there was a hijacker on board or even what was happening. They're like, mechanical issue with the plane. We'll be fine. And so they didn't even know that this was all happening until they actually exited the plane, which I'm sure they were very thankful for. You know, imagine if that were you. I would obviously be very concerned that the plane had been hijacked and I was on that plane. But at that moment, I'd be like, man, I'm glad I got off that plane.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they spared them from that. That's nice.
Meanwhile, Northwest Airlines obtained the $200,000 in unmarked $20 bills from Seattle's First National Bank. Because Cooper did not specify the denomination, they said, we'll get him with this one. Instead of $100 bills, give him 20s, baby. So they gave him 10,000 $20 bills, which weighs around 23 pounds.
He's like, fuck.
Yeah. And this honestly, this harder. Could be the straw that broke camel's back. Quite literally.
Yeah.
I mean, 23 pounds, that's heavy. And when you're talking about parachuting, that's a big deal. You know, weight distribution is very important. What was also smart is that the FBI took microfilm photos of every single bill before they were bundled and bagged for delivery to the airport. So they knew exactly what cash they were giving him, yep. All the serial numbers, all that good stuff.
Super crush.
Because they're like, well, if he does somehow get away with it, we'll catch him because he'll go on a, you know, spending spree and eventually we'll find the cash. Or that's what they thought. At 5:24 p.m., Captain Scott was told that the parachutes had arrived along with the ransom money, and he alerted Cooper that they would be landing soon. Cooper's like, yeah, it worked.
So the flight landed at 5:46 p.m. and the airplane's aft stairway was lowered. Tina retrieved the money and the parachutes before returning and giving them to Cooper. And at that point, all passengers were allowed to exit the plane. Cooper inspected the money and Tina asked jokingly if she could have some. And he actually said yes and handed her a bundle of cash. Now, she denied, citing a company policy, and he attempted to give her and the other attendants and the flight crew even more cash throughout the flight. So
she
a real gentleman.
Took that money, though.
Yeah.
Because what is the airlines going to do? Our employee was in a hijacking, but in the hijacker gave her
Are
some money.
Are you kidding me? They would have
so
taken that
we're
shit
firing
right
you. No way,
She
dude.
Should have taken it and then told nobody, and no one ever would have known.
True. But even if they did find out, I can imagine they would have done anything to her. Mm-hmm. She could have just been like, well, he forced me to take it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a reward. Seriously, she was brave. But Cooper then drew the blinds on the airplane windows, likely to avoid being spotted by an FBI sniper that he was sure was on the tarmac. And after the passengers left, Florence asked Cooper if the flight attendants could leave too, to which he responded, quote, whatever you girls would like. See, a gentleman. Florence and Alice Hancock left the plane, but Tina remained. She handed Cooper an instruction manual for operating the parachutes, but he said, I don't need that shit. I got this. However, he did complain about the bag that they had given to him to secure the cash because he said it wouldn't be durable enough.
Did they give him like a plastic grocery bag?
Thank you for shopping here.
Yeah.
So out of the four parachutes that he was given, two of them were military, and then one was a civilian sport chute, and then one, which this is crazy, it was entirely on accident. They gave him a dummy chute.
Was it though?
I know, I wonder that too. But they claim it was an accident.
I don't know.
But I don't know. You have to think about the fact that they thought he was going to possibly take hostages with them and they would be putting their lives in danger.
Yeah,
so maybe
so
it really
what if
was
he
an
put
accident.
A dummy chute on a, you know, a
right.
hostage? I've been bad.
Yeah, and that would have been on the FBI.
It could have just been there scrambling, you know, rushing to get this stuff, and they just were like, oh, we got to get these, and somebody happened to throw them.
Can someone explain to me why they even have dummy chutes? Like, what is the point of that?
So it's for, it's like for a skydiving school. It's for training people how to pull the ripcord without actually deploying a chute.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. And apparently, from what I understand, is that this was incredibly last minute. And so originally they were going to get the four chutes from McCord, but then Coop was all like, no, 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 I want the civilian sport chute. Mm-hmm. And so then they had to contact this random skydiving school that was like a 15-minute drive from the airport. And imagine you're just some guy at some podunk skydiving school, and it's like, okay, we're the FBI.
Yeah.
There's a plane that's being hijacked. We need you to get four parachutes together. Like,
pronto.
Pronto. I can imagine how that guy accidentally grabbed a dummy chute.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense.
It's just a complete mess in his, like, storage closet. He's like, oh, shit. I wasn't planning on seeing anybody here today. Well, let me grab this one, that one, and probably just in a race against time, right?
Yeah. So, or maybe he was the one who purposely gave the dummy chute. He's like a hijacker.
Let's give him this dummy one. But the FBI is not like examining the things that they're getting from them before bringing
it
back to
the
hijacker.
They're moving quick.
I mean, it could also be possible that they were talking with the captain on the plane, because the ATC towers did exist in the 70s. At least I believe they existed. And it may have been that like the crew knew that one of those was a dummy one. So maybe they were trying to like coordinate with them to be like, hey, make sure he gets this parachute and you guys get this one if he, you know, takes someone with
right. him. Right. I would assume that there is at least those types of conversations going on.
Maybe, but that, I mean, you're dealing with a hijacker. What if he's like, fuck no, I'm taking this one, you're taking that one. Would they take that risk?
It's the FBI in the 70s.
I think they took a lot of
casualties. weren't super high on their priority list, or maybe like they were being aggressively stupid and they were thinking, well, we gave him 23 pounds worth of cash. Maybe he's going to strap the bag to a separate parachute. So then give him a, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's the FBI.
That's a good point. That is a good point.
It was a bit disorganized back then. It wasn't quite the machine that it is today.
So Cooper ends up opening one of the military chutes and cut the canopy out of the bag and then stored the money inside of that. However, while the plane sat on the runway waiting to be refueled, two fuel trucks broke down on the way to the plane. Can you imagine? That is some bad luck. Two broke down. Cooper grew.
Or did they? You know, it's hard to say. Maybe they did it on purpose to try to wait it out a little bit before they just give in to his demands. Maybe they're trying to like play a little game with him and see.
That could have been. But maybe they would have reported that. I don't know.
I mean,
there's so much unknown.
Again,
so old.
Like I was talking about earlier, the golden age of hijacking really started in 1968. So by 1971, you would have think the FBI would have had a protocol, a plan, a strategy.
Hey, I mean, you would think. You would think that strategy would have been security measures by then. I mean,
right.
They were like 3 years deep at that point.
Their strategy at this point really openly was just give in to their demands. Like, that literally was
do whatever
their,
they say.
Do whatever. I would say, to give some credence to the possibility that they, you know, broke down on purpose, there is a possibility that they were making him wait long enough to see if he would open one of the blinds and then take the sniper shot.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is that there's...
Yeah, that's a good point, actually.
By that point, I'm sure they were getting tired of this whole ransom game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure the airlines were getting pretty tired of it as well. So if there's a way to, like, you know, cut the time that this takes to resolve down a bit, I think maybe they would try it. Because it's like, come on, two trucks?
Yeah, that's pretty...
Like, break down?
Yeah.
I'm skeptical.
But, you know, while Cooper is waiting for these two trucks and he hears that they're broken down, he starts getting impatient. And he says, this is probably the nastiest thing Cooper said. And it's not that nasty. He said, let's get this show on the road.
And this has got to be censored. Like, he got to be like, what the fuck is going on?
No. He was a gentleman.
Okay. Well, let's think about this for a second. He's closing the blinds of the airplane because he's worried about being sniped in the head by somebody. And he's calmly saying, yeah, let's get this show on the road, folks. I could be shot at any point in time. He doesn't know what the FBI is going to do. He doesn't know what could happen.
Well, why would they lie about what he said? To try to protect him?
No.
I believe that this is pretty spot on to what he said.
You know,
believe the flight attendants.
Stories over the years get told and retold and details change.
It's true. The game of
telephone. Because again, there's kind of this like lore and legend around D.B. Cooper that maybe it's gotten a little soft to make him look a little bit. Maybe he was just like, what the hell's going on?
I don't want to believe that.
But again, according to the flight attendants, he was cordial and polite. Yeah. Yep. So what do I know?
You know, to his credit, though, about closing the blinds, this was also not too long after like the JFK assassination. Mm-hmm. And like it was kind of at the height of like people kind of being like, the Warren Commission finished up and like maybe this, you know, was like a little bit more to it. So there was a lot of like public conspiracies against the FBI. So
yeah, that's a good point.
Cause I like to think, I mean, he was clearly somewhat intelligent in his planning. So, you know, I and the fact he's just cigarette. And maybe he was just a chain smoker and that's just what he did, but also, maybe he was extremely nervous and that he was going to be shot and killed if they didn't get off the ground soon enough. So, I don't know. But let's get this show on the road, folks. You know, it's like...
It's really awesome.
It's like, it's just too legendary.
We used to be a proper damn country.
Right? It's like, we used to be polite.
So, at this point, the FAA requested a face-to-face meeting with Cooper, which he obviously declined. And instead, Cooper discussed further demands with the flight crew. He wanted the plane to fly to Mexico City at a reduced speed of 200 miles an hour, with the cabin depressurized and the landing gear down. And not only that, he also wanted the wing flaps lowered by 15 degrees. Cooper was told that at that speed, the plane would have to be refueled once more before reaching Mexico City. So they agreed on the Reno Tahoe International Airport. He also wished that every note that he had exchanged between him and the flight crew be returned to him, which was quite a smart move because that is how they had caught other hijackers, was through their handwriting.
So basically, he wanted to take off and then just stay in that mode for the entire trip down to Reno.
Yeah.
I assume to like cut down on time, maybe. I don't know. But
and just more risk.
But also, as we'll find out, you know, keep the plan low and slow for what happens next.
Right. So Cooper demanded that the aft stairwell be lowered throughout the flight. Northwestern officials told him that they couldn't because that would be a safety hazard. And while he initially objected, saying, quote, it can be done. Do it. He eventually relented because he said if Tina stayed on board and showed him how to operate the aft stairwell once it becomes airborne, then he's cool with that. So the 727 took off from Seattle Tacoma at 7:40 p.m. and three fighter jets followed the plane. However, their minimum speed was still faster than the speed that Cooper demanded. So they had to circle back and just keep their eyes on the plane without alerting Cooper to their presence.
Yeah, because, I mean, fighter planes aren't going to be flying at 200 miles per hour. They got to fly much, much faster. So they're just kind of, you know, flying around the general area And at, you know, as we'll get into, weather wasn't good. Mm-mm. Wasn't great. So visibility for those fighter jets would have been pretty low. But again, they don't know what's going to happen. They don't know if he's going to somehow force his way into the cockpit possibly, or, you know, they don't know what his next move is going to be.
We've all heard the stories, missing persons, double lives, suspicious basements, but here's one mystery you don't need in your life. Why can't my kid learn to ride a bike? For a lot of families, it turns into a saga. Meltdowns in the driveway, scraped knees, and frustrated parents Googling how to teach a kid to ride a bike without losing your mind. Well, that's where Guardian Bikes comes in. Their bikes are lightweight, low to the ground, and built to help kids find their balance fast. Most are riding confidently in just one day. No training wheels, no tears, just high fives and I did it moments. It's everything learning to ride should be. Simple, smooth, and actually fun. So skip the struggle and start with a bike that's made to make it easy. Go to guardianbikes.com. You'll save hundreds when comparing Guardian to its competitors. Plus, get a free bike lock and pump of $50 value with your first purchase when you join their newsletter. That's guardianbikes.com.
But once they were in the air, Cooper asked Tina to lower the stairwell, and she expressed some fear, saying that she was afraid that she'd be sucked out of the airplane if she did this. She asked if she could retrieve an emergency rope from the cockpit to fasten herself to one of the seats, which this must have been absolutely terrifying to get this request. I mean, I think all of us are scared of the door opening mid-flight on a plane. I know it's not possible, but back then, sure was. So it was definitely a real fear that she had.
I feel so bad for her. That must have been so traumatizing.
But Cooper was not down with her going over to the cockpit. And, you know, he didn't want her to go and get the other crew members come back and overpower him. So she asked if he could cut some of the parachute he had already removed to store the money. But once again, he said no. Instead, he just asked her to show him how to operate the stairwell himself, and she could go to the cockpit before he lowered it. Before she left him, Tina begged Cooper to take the bomb with him, and Cooper promised her that he would either disarm the bomb or bring it with him. As Tina made her way back to the cockpit, she turned around at the partition between coach and first class and looked back at him. He tied the money bag to his waist with cords from the parachute, and this was the very last time anyone ever saw Mr. Dan Cooper. At 8 p.m., with Tina now secured in the cockpit with the rest of the flight crew, a warning light indicated that the stairwell had been deployed. Captain Scott spoke through the plane's intercom system and asked Cooper if he needed any help, to which he just said, no. At 8:13 p.m., the plane pitched upward, indicating Cooper likely jumped off of the stairwell. Still, the flight crew couldn't be certain. Hours later, Tina spoke on the intercom to tell Cooper that they were approaching Reno and he needed to raise the stairwell. However, there was no response. At 11:02 p.m., the plane landed in Reno, with that aft staircase still extended, and miraculously, it wasn't even that badly damaged. Captain Scott searched the cabin to see if Cooper was still on board. However, the only things that remained were the cut parachute, an unused civilian parachute, 8 Raleigh cigarette butts, and Cooper's clip-on tie. After an FBI bomb squad searched the plane and found no sign of the briefcase bomb, it was official. D.B. Cooper had vanished into the sky above Washington. Gone into the night. Aside from the clip-on tie and cigarette butts, FBI agents were able to pull 62 fingerprints from various surfaces on the plane near where Cooper was sitting, as well as 2 hairs pulled from the seat Cooper sat in. They also observed the parachutes Cooper had left behind. One was the one that he had cut open to store the money within before the jump. Curiously, the other parachute he had left behind was that civilian sport parachute, which would have allowed him to steer the chute as he descended from the aircraft. Instead, Cooper took the dummy chute and one of the military chutes, which again was sturdy, but would be impossible to steer. It's impossible to know which of the 2 chutes Cooper used for his main and which he used for his backup, which means there was a chance that Cooper unknowingly used the dummy chute as his primary and just fell out of the sky like a ton of bricks.
As much as I want to believe he got away with it, he's out there living his best. That's my number one theory. I think he hit that dummy.
I don't know. I don't believe that.
Why? It's 50-50 odds.
I think he knew enough
I don't think so.
I think he knew enough that he wouldn't have taken, he wouldn't have used the dummy chute as his main.
Well, how would he even have known it was a dummy chute?
I think you could probably figure it out.
At this time, at least from what I could tell, most dummy chutes were kind of like, that's the reason there was the mix-up. You actually couldn't
tell the difference?
Yeah. You couldn't tell the difference until you pulled it or opened it.
And well, what if he opened it?
That's the thing.
He did open one of them, right? Because he pulled it out.
Yeah, he pulled the other.
He opened the one of the military ones to stuff the money. But we don't know if he ever checked the dummy chute.
Right, so there is a chance there that he did
a 50-50 chance.
No, there's a chance he pulled the dummy chute on the plane before he jumped to find out if it was the dummy chute or not. If he had four chutes, decided he was going to take those two and gotten lucky and pulled one of the chutes that happened to be the dummy chute before jumping, then use that to wrap the cash or whatever else he was bringing with him.
No, he wrapped the cash in the military one.
Do we know all the cash? We don't know how. We know he.
You think
has
he like divided it up?
Yeah, I do. It was 20. I think he was smarter than we give him credit for. I think he was like, I've got to distribute this weight a little bit more evenly here. He didn't just like put 23 pounds on his chest and jump.
I think people like to believe he was really smart. He also picked like the worst time to do this.
Yeah, the weather was not great. We'll talk more about that. But
I don't think he's that smart, and I think he used the dummy one, and that was probably a shitty moment.
All right, Kendall.
So obviously the FBI at this point immediately began questioning suspects in the Seattle-Portland area. And then reporter James Long, which I had no idea about this. This was so interesting to me. He was under a deadline to get that news out quick, break the hijacking story before anyone else. And he mistakenly referred to the hijacker as D.B. Cooper instead of his chosen alias of Dan Cooper. A press wire service republished the mistake. And even after a Portland area man named D.B. Cooper was questioned, the name stuck in the press and Dan Cooper would forever be known as D.B. Cooper. The FBI attempted to retrace the flight path and find a potential landing zone, but the cloudy Pacific Northwest winter made it impossible to locate individual landmarks that could have been seen by the flight crew or the three jets that tailed them. And on top of that, due to cloud coverage on the night that Cooper jumped, these same military jets didn't see when Cooper jumped either, meaning they had no idea when he would have pulled the ripcord or when he jumped in the first place. In addition, the wind speeds that the FBI used to calculate his potential drop zone were recorded inaccurately. And Captain Scott's flight path was also inaccurate because he had to fly the plane manually per Cooper's speed restriction. So during the spring of 1972, the FBI and a team of over 200 soldiers, National Guardsmen, and civilians searched throughout Washington's rural wooded area for 36 days between April and May. A submarine searched Lake Merwin with depths reaching up to 200 feet. However, no searches turned up any evidence whatsoever. 3 hours after Cooper jumped, a convenience store in Hyzen, Washington was burglarized. However, whoever did it only took food, gloves, and other items necessary to survive the wilderness. Now, while Hyson was in the calculated Cooper drop zone, the assailant reportedly wore military boots instead of those brown loafers that Cooper was last seen wearing. Multiple composite drawings of Cooper were made, including him wearing his now famous sunglasses, and he was described as white with olive skin, black hair, and in his late 30s or mid 40s.
Let's just talk about his sketch.
Yeah.
Because famous. It looks like every other white male at the time.
Yeah. Not great. Not great. And he looks way less cool without the glasses.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, I watched so many documentaries for this. And in one of them, they took one of the suspects who we'll talk about later and they put the composite drawing over him. And they were like, look. It's exactly him. And I'm like, you could do that. You could do that with any one of us in this room. And we'd be like, holy fucking shit, Josh is D.B. Cooper. Like,
yep. Really good. But those documentaries are always trying to grasp for that like aha moment. Mm-hmm. We've solved it.
What happened to Mr. D.B. Cooper? With the entire country searching for the only unsolved skyjacker in history, you'd assume something would turn up. Well, surprise, nothing really nothing ever did. Mm-mm. Except for one thing, one piece that kind of throws a wrench into this whole story, really. Well, if we remember back to the cash, the serial numbers of all 10,000 $20 bills were released to the public, and not a single one re-entered circulation. And what about all that evidence they found on the plane? Well, none of the 62 fingerprints matched anyone on the plane, including some known passengers. And let's remember all of that forensic evidence found on the plane. Well, none of the 62 fingerprints matched anyone on the plane, including known passengers. The Raleigh cigarette butts were untested for DNA, because of course, this was before DNA technology was around, and it was ultimately destroyed in 1980, which sucks, because like if they had preserved that and preserved it well, there'd probably still be a chance to maybe figure this one out. And same goes for the two hairs that they found on his seat, which that's pretty solid DNA right there. And while two samples were found on the tie, it had been passed around so much that any original evidence was now completely tampered with. I mean, it's no good. But here's the big question. If no one reported a man matching Cooper's description as missing, his drop zone couldn't be accurately calculated, and none of his ransom money ever re-entered circulation. So who are they even looking for? Did he even survive the fall? Those are the big questions. While multiple people have been able to recreate Cooper's jump using the same altitude and speed as the hijacked 727, they did miss some key elements. For one, Cooper jumped long after sunset. And if the Pacific Northwest is known for one thing, especially during November, it's cloudy skies, a lot of rain, a lot of storms. And the night that Cooper jumped, that's exactly what was going on. It was rainy, stormy. There would have been thick clouds at 5,000 feet that would have completely obscured his view of the drop zone. And in addition to this, the ground temperatures were around 30 degrees Fahrenheit, meaning that Cooper's altitude of 10,000 feet, you can bet your ass it was cold up there. And my guy was not prepared for that kind of weather. I mean, he had a trench coat, a suit. Like, you would have thought he would have brought some better gear.
No, see, he didn't think a lot of this through. That's why I don't think he was smart enough to know the difference between the regular parachute and a dummy.
Okay. I guess it was prime travel season around the holidays, so still busy. I would have been busy in the summer, too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, why not think about the environmental conditions a little bit? Or it just was kind of a on the fly type.
He decided like that morning.
He was like on the fly, like, oh, here's an idea. How about I just jump out of here?
I got some dynamite laying around.
Gracefully glide down. So back to the temperature at 10,000 feet, it would have been negative 15 degrees outside. So super cold, not to mention wet. While no witnesses saw Cooper's actual jump, he did not carry a jumpsuit or protective clothing of any kind, at least as far as we know. In all likelihood, he jumped into sub-zero temperatures wearing only his suit and those brown loafers. Great plan, dude. His feet would have been frozen by the... I mean, imagine land... Because, you know, when you glide down in a parachute, you eventually got to, like, put your feet down and almost, like, run out.
Yeah.
Of the, you know, you ever see people skydiving, they do that?
Yep.
His feet would have been... That would have hurt so fucking bad. You imagine how cold his feet would have been?
Could have had like hypothermia.
Did he have socks in his loafers, you think? Or he just went straight loafers, no socks?
Maybe he kicked the loafers off in the air and the dogs were free.
Just bare. At negative 15
degrees. They're like
degrees.
Turned blue by the time he's at the bottom.
So I wonder if he knew he was jumping to his death. Or if he thought there was a chance he was going to make it out of that.
I think he thought there was a chance, yeah. I mean, you thought a lot of this through, man.
The more I go through this, the more my mind is changing. I'm like, oh, I thought you thought this through a little bit more. But maybe underneath the bomb in his briefcase, he had a hidden compartment that had it all of his rain gear.
Mm-hmm.
And he had like little waterproof socks, little water shoes. I mean, yeah, nobody searched him when he went through the airport, so it's possible maybe he had some stuff like hidden in his pants, hidden in his jacket, his suit. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm holding out hope for him that he...
If it makes you feel better, Josh, I have a very elaborate theory on how he survived that I'll save for later.
All right.
Oh, I can't wait.
I think that I genuinely have an answer for all of this.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So here's a possibility. Because it's cloudy, it's rainy, it's horrible conditions to skydive in, it is likely he wouldn't have been able to see any sort of drop zone whatsoever. I mean, we're also talking about the very heavily forested areas of Washington. So it's just extremely possible he slammed into the side of a mountain or got his parachute caught in tall trees. Or it's also very possible that he just splashed down into a lake or river in the region. And that's why he's not been found. He's dead on impact. And then he just sank to the bottom of a lake. It's possible. Again, if Cooper died on impact shortly after, why didn't the FBI ever find anything, especially a parachute canopy? I mean, that it's, I can understand like a human body disintegrating from that kind of impact, but parachute canopy, you would think that that would, there'd be some remnants of it left over even after a fall from that height. While it's possible he survived the landing and was able to pack it away before succumbing to the elements, he's like, oh, shit, I didn't bring my survival kit. Damn. But again, back to what we were talking about earlier, it's also possible because he took that dummy chute with him, we don't know if he used it for his primary or secondary chute. So there's a possibility his main chute failed to open, maybe, and then he tried to pull the dummy chute, and then, you know what happens next. He just plummeted to the ground. And again, at those speeds with zero resistance from a parachute, there'd be absolutely nothing left of Cooper once he hit the ground, especially if he just like smashed into a mountain or something, you know, a bunch of rock or even just some trees. It would just shred you to pieces.
Exploded.
But again, I still think somebody would have stumbled on it. I think there'd been something.
Maybe.
Especially with the search that happened. I mean, we're talking about a serious search that went down. And there was nothing, not a trace. At all? I guess there's a lot of forest out there.
Also, this was in the 70s, okay? Their skills, they weren't that great. Let's be honest.
They really... This is where drones could have been a big, big help for them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're just like walking...
Like infrared technology, they didn't... Yeah, so...
What is cool, though, is they got one of those SR-71 Blackbirds out there. You know, those really cool all-black, like, spy planes. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
Very famous.
Fucking awesome.
They're awesome.
Really?
Yeah. And this was like the best of the best technology at the time. You've seen this plane before. It's famous. The Lockheed SR-71.
Nope. You know me.
No?
I don't
okay.
know nothing.
How fast can
about planes?
A Lockheed, how fast can this thing fly around the world? I know it's got like an insane.
Real fucking
yeah.
Fast.
As Tom actually has quite a background in aviation.
I mean, the coolest thing my dad flew was a, F-117, the Nighthawk plane.
Oh, that's sweet.
Oh,
that's
yeah, so did. Cool.
Yeah, he got to do one of those before they were like official. Over 2,200 miles per hour. So, I mean, 2,200 miles per hour, and the total circumference of the Earth is what? 24,000 miles. So, I mean, you know, rough math, fast.
Yeah. Very fast.
Yeah, basically, holy yeah, shit. I remember like watching like a mini documentary on SR-71. I want to say, I could be thinking of a different plane, but I think one of the pilots said you basically could see the sun rise like three different times because you could go fast enough around that you would like start at one point in time and then see it again. And then by the time you landed, it was rising again kind of thing. I don't remember.
Damn, I can't even wrap my mind around that. That's wild.
Why aren't these planes used for commercial air travel?
Yeah, like, come on.
Well, we tried to with Concorde and then
right, yeah,
it didn't go great.
Didn't end so well. Yeah. But yeah, they pulled one of these guys out to even go and photograph the area to try to look at some high detail photographs, see if they could locate anything. And there ain't nothing. There's nothing.
Because he exploded, dude. He's gone.
Yeah, and his parachute, though, too, his loafers. Come on, man. Those were some high-quality loafers. There's no way those loafers did not survive the fall. I understand a squishy human made of water, but loafers, dude? Like,
okay.
Let's be honest. Like, I think his loafers are out there, man.
I think it'd be very funny if they found a skeleton in the woods that's, like, totally nothing on it except for the loafers. Still made it.
Holding awesome. The ripcord.
Yeah.
So obviously no one would advise jumping. I mean, night skydiving, there's a reason it's not advisable, right?
Yeah.
Visibilities.
Do people ever do that?
That's a good question.
I feel like I've never seen
I think there's certain rules
sure
around skydiving because I just was looking up, can you skydive in a thunderstorm? Kind of like the night that he did. And there's rules around it, actually. You have to be certain distance away from clouds, but Red Bull skydivers still do crazy shit like that.
Yeah.
They'll go like do skydive, cloud boarding.
I want to see. Can we look up clouds. Skydiving at night?
Well, the military does it.
Yeah.
The military does that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. but a civilian. Skydiving at night with fire.
Okay. Oh, this is sweet.
Oh shit.
Oh, they had like a, well, like little fireworks on them.
I guess so. Yeah.
They've got to be much higher than.
Okay,
10,000
so it's not
feet.
Pitch night. It's like sunset.
Yeah.
But that's sick.
Or maybe that's dawn, actually.
We've all heard the stories, missing persons, double lives, suspicious basements, but here's one mystery you don't need in your life. Why can't my kid learn to ride a bike? For a lot of families, it turns into a saga. Meltdowns in the driveway, scraped knees, and frustrated parents Googling how to teach a kid to ride a bike without losing your mind. Well, that's where Guardian Bikes comes in. Their bikes are lightweight, low to the ground, and built to help kids find their balance fast. Most are riding confidently in just one day. No training wheels, no tears, just high fives and I did it moments. It's everything learning to ride should be. Simple, smooth, and actually fun. So skip the struggle and start with a bike that's made to make it easy. Go to guardianbikes.com. You'll save hundreds when comparing Guardian to its competitors. Plus, get a free bike lock and pump, a $50 value with your first purchase when you join their newsletter. That's guardianbikes.com. So even though his nighttime jump seems pretty improbable when we talk about surviving something like that, as far as hijacking an airplane and then parachuting away, well, that was actually not all that rare. Because 1 year after Cooper's heist, it happened again. Because they're like, damn, this guy's legendary. What a great plan.
Let's try it again,
dude. like, I want to try this. I want money.
So on April 27th, 1972, a man named Wayne McCoy boarded another Boeing 727 while it was making a stopover in Denver en route to Los Angeles. And using notes to communicate with the flight attendants and the crew, McCoy, who was using the pseudonym James Johnson, had brought a pistol and a hand grenade to hijack the plane. McCoy asked for $500,000, stuffed the ransom money in a duffel bag, and equipped a flight suit. McCoy made a daytime jump over relatively flat terrain during the spring. Much smarter situation here. He then hitchhiked outside of a fast food restaurant and was ultimately picked up by a motorist who later reported the interaction to police. Now, McCoy, who was actually a National Guardsman, and he was on duty flying a helicopter looking for the hijacker, aka himself, real sneaky dude, police obtained a warrant following the tip from the motorist who had picked McCoy up and matched the handwriting samples. So inside McCoy's house, they found his flight suit and they found the duffel bag carrying $499,970. So $30 was missing.
And he probably spent it on burgers. I can't remember what fast food place it was specifically, but I'm pretty sure it was a Burger King.
Mm.
But still, $30 in burgers back then.
Yeah.
Like 100 and something. Today
they're like a quarter back then.
Yeah, I know. So it's like, how many did he buy? Like 300 burgers.
He just went maybe into the restaurant like, free food for everybody.
Yeah,
that would be so epic.
Maybe he did.
That would be so epic.
Maybe he did.
It's Wednesday, everybody gets a burger.
Where did that $30 go? Or maybe he paid someone to help him with something, or maybe the motorist.
And you know, I bet that if he did give the motorist like $30 and then the motorist, when he told police, was probably like, oh yeah, no, you didn't give me any fucking money.
Yeah, I bet you that's what it was. That would make sense. So McCoy was arrested and ultimately sentenced to 45 years at the federal penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Now here, McCoy's story greatly deviates from Cooper's, because on August 10th, 1974, he ended up fashioning a fake handgun made out of hardened toothpaste, which is pretty fucking awesome. And him and a crew of prisoners used the fake gun to steal a garbage truck and then just smashed out of the prison gates. Two of the escaped convicts were captured only 3 days later following a shootout during an attempted bank robbery. Then 3 months later, McCoy was tracked to Virginia Beach, Virginia, where agents were able to find the home that he shared with one of the other escaped convicts. And on November 9th, 1974, McCoy was actually gunned down by FBI agents after he fired on them from inside of his home. McCoy's hijacking draws a lot of similarities to Cooper's. I mean, they both picked Boeing 727s, and that was because of the aft staircase. They used notes to communicate with the flight crew, and they were familiar with the aircraft. So obviously, McCoy was immediately suspected of being D.B. Cooper.
But come on. There's definitely some differences between the two. For one, Cooper was smart enough to ask for those notes to be returned to him before he jumped, meaning that his handwriting could never be analyzed. And McCoy spoke to his friends before his hijacking about the Cooper case, which really signals to all of us that McCoy is just a shitty copycat, honestly. He just was like, damn, sure he thought he was better, you know, before it all ended for him. But that's what's interesting too, is like nobody has come forward to knowing him, like verifying like he told them about this plan or anything like that. And as opposed to these other hijackers, they went and told other people. So that's very odd to me. While Cooper was suspected of being in the military at the time of his jump, McCoy poked some holes in this theory, because McCoy had served as a demolition expert and pilot in Vietnam. He brought a flight suit for his jump because he knew how brutal the air temperatures were at 10,000 feet in the air. Plus, McCoy would have been in his 20s during the Cooper hijacking, which places him pretty far outside of the age range that witnesses describe Cooper being. Although he did look quite a bit like D.B. Cooper's composite sketch, it's pretty safe to assume, as we mentioned earlier, that pretty much most white guys in the 1970s could have looked like that Cooper sketch. Because there's nothing like, there's no like unique marks or any sort of, it's not very detailed, right? It's just like a rough little sketch. The FBI has suspected McCoy since the 1970s and asked his family for DNA samples concerning the Cooper case all the way in 2004. However, the most significant departure from the Cooper case is that McCoy was caught only a few days after his hijacking with most of the money accounted for. Cooper disappeared without a trace, and the only dollar bills found in relation to him would turn up along a riverbed in 1980. And this is literally the only thing found that can be connected to this incident. That's crazy. And this is what's very weird. This part right here is odd to me. But again, there's possible theories to explain why. But listen to this. On February 10th, 1980, 8-year-old Brian Ingram was camping with his family on a sandy beachfront known as Tina Bar along the Columbia River. Brian was raking the sand to build a campfire when he found three bundles of $20 bills wrapped with rubber bands. After counting the money, the Ingram family not only realized that they had found $5,800, but they were all bills that were given to D.B. Cooper, and they were all in the same order that he had initially received them back in 1971. And we actually have a clip that we want to show you.
Investigation came Sunday when Dwayne and Patricia Ingram's 8-year-old son overturned some sand while walking the shoreline of the Columbia River near Vancouver, Washington. The public learned in an FBI news conference Tuesday, little Brian Ingram unearthed several packets of deteriorated $20 bills, and the FBI confirmed it. It was indeed several thousand of the $200,000 that bailed out with D.B. Cooper on the eve of Thanksgiving back in 1971.
Well, we were going to make a campfire, and we found it was partially on top of the ground. You know, it was just beneath the sand.
Who found it?
Well, my son and I found it together. I was getting ready to drop the wood, and he cleared out the spot and rolled the money over on top of the sand.
FBI agents scoured the area of the Ingrams' find. At one point, a geologist was called in to determine whether money could be buried below the surface level in dredge material deposited on the beach in 1974. On Wednesday, that geologist confirmed the money washed ashore. That meant there could be deposits of money anywhere along a 100-mile stretch of beach.
Searching in the sand on a deserted Columbia beach, finding bits of money along the high water mark. That's what's changed the whole myth of a man named Dan Cooper. People thought he landed on the west side of the range, but his money was found to be on the east side. That's how it drifted downriver. And now that's what's changing the whole search and the whole story of D.B. Cooper.
Well, shit.
Pretty cool find.
he must have landed and built himself a little campfire on the beach and buried some money there.
Is that what you think happened?
You know, he's probably pretty wet and cold after that jump. First thing I do is build a campfire.
With the FBI after you?
Yeah, what? Well, you got to warm up. You're not going to get very far if you've got okay. frostbite all over you.
So to this day, the find at Tina Bar is the only time any of the money given to D.B. Cooper has actually been found. And naturally, it led to lots of speculation. For one, the Columbia River flows upstream from Vancouver, meaning if the money was lost the night of D.B. Cooper's jump, his drop zone would have been several miles further south than initially thought. And even still, the bills would have traveled several miles along the river before washing up at Tina Bar, making it highly unlikely that all three bundles would have remained together. In 1974, an Army Corps of Engineers performed a dredging operation, leaving two distinct layers of sediment on the bar. And after the 1980 find, it was determined that the bills were found above this new layer of sediment, meaning they would have arrived after 1974. Though modern analysis disputes this find, they claim that the layer was actually a layer of clay that had been at Tina Bar before the 1974 dredging operation. It was also determined that the bills had not been submerged significantly, as the rubber bands that were wrapped around them would have been deteriorated less than a year in the water. In 2020, an analysis of the microalgae found on the bills determined that they were buried during the spring season, at least months after Cooper's hijacking. But still, others dispute this and have said that the money simply washed up after Cooper's failed jump. However, one thing was for sure, Brian Ingram was a very lucky guy. He actually was allowed to keep several of the bills, and he sold 15 of them at auction in 2008 for $37,000. So, big slave.
I'm glad they did that.
I am too.
You know, the FBI deserved. Couldn't find shit, and then this kid finds the only evidence that remains.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, all right, man, you helped us out, so.
Well deserved.
Here's a few bills.
Well deserved.
He should have held on to those, though, and waited as long as possible. Yeah.
No, they did the right thing, and morals get
no, I'm
a
just saying
reward.
They should have just like held on to the bills that they did get and not have sold them in auction 2008, because I bet those bitches go up in value.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean? You're right.
37 in 2008, I bet they're worth a lot more now.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
But somebody would have paid $1 million for those.
Mm. Interesting.
Some D.B. Cooper fanatic or
and
some
there,
museum.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, people are obsessed with the D.B. Cooper story. And especially in these areas, like they have...
Near the drop zone and Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And
they have full parties. Isn't there a D.B. Cooper Day?
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. I actually believe that the city that does the D.B. Cooper Day and is really obsessed with it is in Canada. Actually.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. I remember seeing that.
Like,
yeah.
Huh, okay.
Like the footage at the bars where they were all like... And then they all have their theories of, oh, I think he got away. He's a hero.
I think it's my fucking grandpa.
Yeah. Like. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or I think he's living on the beach in Mexico, sipping the margs, living it big. It's fun to think about.
Yeah. Ariel Washington has a D.B. Cooper date, November 24th.
Okay. That would make sense.
Yep.
Yeah.
We've all heard the stories, missing persons, double lives, suspicious basements, but here's one mystery you don't need in your life. Why can't my kid learn to ride a bike? For a lot of families, it turns into a saga. Meltdowns in the driveway, scraped knees, and frustrated parents Googling how to teach a kid to ride a bike without losing your mind. Well, that's where Guardian Bikes comes in. Their bikes are lightweight, low to the ground, and built to help kids find their balance fast. Most are riding confidently in just one day. No training wheels, no tears, just high fives and I did it moments. It's everything learning to ride should be. Simple, smooth, and actually fun. So skip the struggle and start with a bike that's made to make it easy. Go to guardianbikes.com. You'll save hundreds when comparing Guardian to its competitors. Plus, get a free bike lock and pump. A $50 value with your first purchase when you join their newsletter. That's guardianbikes.com.
But to this day, that money that was found at Tina Bar is the only additional piece of evidence regarding D.B. Cooper at all. Since the 1971 hijacking, the FBI has investigated over 700 individuals in connection with D.B. Cooper. Investigators ruled all of them out for one reason or another. Lots of time spent on that. And on top of that, Thousands of people over the years have claimed to be D.B. Cooper on their deathbed or claimed that their family member was secretly him all along. And it really seems like a way for a lot of people to kind of get a 15 minutes of fame, or maybe they get like that into the theory that they start to believe it, or,
well, you know. People always come out and try to claim that they're one of these notorious criminals, right?
Or like the Zodiac killer. Yeah, exactly. It's my grandpa type situation. Yeah.
Anytime there's a mystery like this and there's no way to, you know, say yes or no because there's just no evidence, people like to insert themselves.
Mm-hmm. In 2016, the FBI closed its investigation on D.B. Cooper, though some say they are still quietly investigating the findings, and maybe they are. But they did begin to release all of the files to the public. And since over 700 people are named in those thousands of papers, we are going to go over three that have come up the most in the recent years, starting with ex-Army man, ex-pilot, and potentially ex-CIA agent Robert Rackstraw.
So Mr. Robert was briefly considered a suspect in the early 1970s, but was ruled out quickly as he was far too young at the time of the hijacking. But still, Robert had a very colorful life. He served as a paratrooper during Vietnam and potentially did work for the CIA while he was overseas. He also worked for the U.S. government in Iran, training the Shah's men to fly fighter planes before the Iranian Revolution in 1978. He was arrested on charges of murdering his stepfather, but he was acquitted in 1978. However, according to independent Cooper investigator Thomas Colbert, who bears some resemblance to Stephen Colbert, no relation though, he said that Robert was convicted of aircraft theft, possession of explosives, and check fraud. Robert's attorney couldn't confirm these charges, but Robert himself has said, quote, "I was acquitted of everything, as I recall." Thomas Colbert maintained that Robert was Cooper until he died in 2019. In the documentary D.B. Cooper, Where Are You?, Colbert is seen approaching and harassing Robert multiple times, which we don't like. Cooper investigators have said that Colbert pigeonholed himself by focusing on Robert. And while Robert may fit the profile of D.B. Cooper, as he was a paratrooper, the FBI revised their profile of Cooper and said that he likely had no military experience since he didn't prepare for his jump with a proper jumpsuit. So what about someone else? Someone involved perhaps with Northwest Airlines? While numerous investigators and documentaries have pointed to a man named Kenny Christensen, he's just as unlikely as Robert. Because Kenny was a flight attendant for Northwest Airlines, which had experienced a number of strikes. He had been out of work for quite a while, which could explain why he targeted the airline for the hijacking. Though Cooper himself, we remember, said during the hijacking that he didn't have a grudge against the airline. He was very clear about that, but was he lying maybe? While Kenny was a white male who fit the age range, nothing else entirely lined up because he was balding, had no sideburns, and was shorter than witnesses claim D.B. Cooper was. While Kenny was noted to wear a toupee before 1971, it still wouldn't change his lack of height or ability to grow sideburns. And, you know, if you're watching, you can see some comparison photos here. Again, the sketch is not very specific with detail, so anybody could roughly look like the sketch. But people pointed out that Kenny purchased a large property after 1971, and friends and family claimed he made the purchase in cold, hard cash. So where'd he get this cash from? Well, this is just incorrect because Kenny mortgaged the property after selling away some other properties he had, which was easy to find in open public records. Plus, if he had made the purchase in cash, more Cooper money would eventually have been found in circulation. And what's more is that since Kenny was an attendant himself, he would have known how to operate the aft stairwell and wouldn't have needed the help from Tina Mucklow. Plus, it's unlikely that no one would have recognized him in the airport or on the plane since they all worked for the same airline.
But as of this year, one new suspect has entered the conversation, which comes from the contemporary analysis of Cooper's tie. Private Cooper investigator Eric Ulis obtained the tie after the FBI closed its investigation. And after swabbing it for DNA and testing for materials, he determined that the tie had trace amounts of titanium. At the time of the hijacking, only one manufacturing plant in the country used pure titanium, and every manager wore the same JCPenney clip-on tie. So Ulis pointed the finger at a man named Vince Peterson, who worked at the plant as a metallurgist. However, the similarities really stopped there. Vance was 52 in 1971, making him older than the suspected age range. Plus, he had lighter hair, and he parted his hair on the opposite side of Cooper. He had blue eyes, and he was actually missing half of his pinky finger. So that would obviously be something that Tina would have noticed since she sat next to him for so many hours. So since the tie was the only thing that connected Vince to the hijacking, it's important to note that the FBI handled the evidence poorly in this case. As previously mentioned, the cigarette butts and hair were both destroyed in 1980. And not only that, the tie was constantly passed around, and any evidence left on it had likely been compromised. However, all of these investigators have overlooked D.B. Cooper's given name, Dan Cooper. Now, if you are a Canadian out there listening, or at the time, maybe, you would recognize that that name is actually the name of a hero in a comic book series about a pilot who parachutes out of planes after combat. Seems like that was probably the inspiration. But what's interesting is the Dan Cooper series was not published in the United States in 1971, meaning that if the hijacker had been inspired by it, he probably would have been Canadian or at least spent a lot of time there. Members of the FBI even reported that the Canadian Air Force said it was one of their guys, but refused to cooperate in the investigation because of soured tensions during the Cold War. Now, this would explain why Cooper said, quote, American currency instead of just the amount. Perhaps the money never even entered American circulation, but was quickly converted into CAD after the hijacking. And perhaps Cooper didn't even return to the U.S. and lived out his life as a wealthy man up north. The fact of the matter is, there are no surefire suspects, and he may have died that night in 1971. D.B. Cooper could have been any one of the people who claimed to be him on their deathbeds. That's always a possibility. But one thing's for sure, guys. D.B. Cooper will go down in infamy as the only unsolved skyjacking in history, and it's likely to stay that way. Unless we can crack the case here, guys, what do you think?
Yeah. I'll go first because I know I'll be the pity party. I think he exploded. I think he...
I'm with you, Ian.
Yeah, I think he hit the ground and...
Yeah, the dummy used the dummy chute.
Yeah, the dummy used the dummy chute. And the money at Tina Bar, what I think happened there is that I think people were hiking and they found some bundles of cash in the woods. And then they probably took it home. They're like, oh my God, look at this fucking money. And then they realized like, oh shit. This is D.B. Cooper's money. So then I think they went, buried the money at Tina Bar, and we're going to wait until they were like, okay, let's wait till things settle down.
And then we can cash out. But why would they put it back in the water?
See, I don't know.
That's one flaw in that.
Yeah, I'm just kind of spitballing here.
That's an interesting thing to think about. Josh, what are your final thoughts?
I think this was an inside job.
Okay. Explain yourself.
Well, here's an interesting tidbit. So Tina Mucklow, because she, you know, had so much interaction with him, everybody wanted to talk to her, right? The media was like all over her, and she did not like this whatsoever. And so she actually left being a flight attendant and became a nun.
Really?
Yeah. She became a nun, and she was working at this, she ended up going to this convent in Eugene, Oregon, for like, I think it was like 12 years or something. And so some people have sort of proposed this theory that she went into witness protection program because she like changed her name, and it was like this whole thing. And because some people think that she actually did take cash from him that day, and she's the one who went and buried the cash in on the riverbank. Because some people are like, well, the distance, it's not like down the street or anything, but she could have probably made her way over there at some point and buried the cash. So some people...
As a nun?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that people are like, well, she probably wouldn't have been allowed to, like, somebody would have noticed that she left the convent or something, you know. But it is a proposed theory that she maybe assisted in some way in it.
Interesting.
Or there's a theory that the whole flight crew was in on it and on the whole thing, and that they just threw stuff. Like, there's a crazy theory that he never jumped at all, and that they staged it and they threw a little bit of cash out the staircase, but they actually landed and somehow he got off the plane or wasn't ever on the plane at all.
That doesn't really...
And that they created this D.B. Cooper figure and he never existed. And this was actually an inside job by this Northwest Airlines crew. Because again, there was like strikes going on. And so they made this whole thing up. And because think about who were the people that saw this person. Or maybe one of the flight crew had a disguise on or something. And then they got on the plane and they were actually on the flight crew. It's crazy. Don't get me wrong.
That's
it's a
really
crazy
hard
theory.
To believe. There's so many potential holes in that.
Well,
too.
Yeah. And like there's, you know, at least five people that would all have to be like keeping it under wraps.
Yeah.
But I think it's like not out of the realm of possibility.
Well, wouldn't they have like planned better too and not have landed and.
Well, if he was never on board, then the story still makes sense because they're like, yeah, he jumped because there's nobody outside of the crew that verified that he was there.
Again, the people who are just regular passengers didn't know that they were being hijacked, of course.
Right.
So they once they got off the plane and then they were shown the composite sketches, they were like, oh, yeah, that guy talked to the cowboy. Oh, that guy like da da da. So, but again, as we've been speaking this whole time, every white guy looked like that. So there's certainly, I bet, was at least one person on the plane who looked like D.B. Cooper. So
maybe, yeah.
If that theory is correct, yeah. I mean,
because it's possible that the guy was in on it and just got off with the passengers when it landed. And then they staged the whole jumping from the airplane. Hmm.
I think feel like you could poke quite a bit of holes in that, but I don't. That's interesting.
The FBI would say, "Shut the up, dude."
Why'd you censor that? This is Mile Higher.
Because we're the FBI. We don't say fuck.
Okay.
But just a theory. I mean, I'm going to the out there theories, but it is an interesting theory, and at that time period, I don't think it's like completely out of the realm of possibility that maybe it was like. An inside job by the crew.
Ooh,
possibly.
I hadn't even thought about that. It is kind of fun to think about.
But like Tina Mucklow, she's interesting because she, there was like an article that came out in 2011. She like resurfaced and somebody got pictures of her and she hadn't been seen for like 40 years. She like disappeared off of the map. You know, people are like, well, maybe, you know, she might know more than she was leading on. She's trying to cover something up possibly. Again, just pure speculation. And kind of wild. My other theory, though, is like if this person was really on there, it seems like I have a hard time somewhat thinking that this was just a random guy off the street who just executed this to the level that he did, even if it ended in death. You know what I mean? Like everything was pretty well thought out. And at the time, it's not like he just like hop on the internet and like Google this shit, you know, and like devise this plan. So to me, it seems like this person had some knowledge, whether he worked for the airlines at one point or he was. I kind of lean more towards possibly like a CIA operative or something, because the CIA was doing all sorts of wild shit. If you remember at this period in history, right? As Tom mentioned earlier, JFK assassination was going on. There was a lot of other operations going on in the world that the CIA was a part of. So I wonder if, and maybe this is either a rogue CIA agent that just kind of just went, was just like, fuck it, I'm going to go and do this because I just want to get money and disappear. Or it was some type of organized inside operation for whatever reason, which I don't really know what the purpose of it would be. To sabotage the airline industry or something. I don't know. But I kind of go more towards that theory. Although some of the more outlandish theories are fun to think about. But Tom says he's got all the answers. So
I have all the answers from my perspective. I want to make that abundantly clear. There's definitely going to be holes in this one too. But I do genuinely think there is like simple explanations for all the big things. One, I do believe that he was a real person. I do think that he was on the plane for sure. I do think he jumped out, and I think that he was probably pretty damn intelligent and was at the very least somewhat experienced. If he was Canadian, that could kind of explain why nobody was able to find him. That's a different side of the theory. But where my thing goes from is that we know he dug out one of the parachutes, one of the military parachutes while he was on the plane, and he only took the military parachutes with him, which would indicate that he doesn't have casual experience parachuting, but he does have military experience parachuting. And he also knew that McChord Air Force Base was a 15 to 20 minute drive
right.
from Tacoma. So he obviously had some sort of militaristic knowledge to some degree. It may have been something he read about, but no matter what, there is an indication that, you know, again, the 70s, internet didn't exist, YouTube didn't exist. So he had some sort of physical, tangible experience with these things. Now, because we can't verify whether or not he dug the parachute out of the dummy one or whether he dug it out of the other, you know, that is still kind of a 50-50 shot. But if he was experienced and he did have some level of above average knowledge of military parachutes, then I feel like he would have looked in both of them, because he would have known, oh, well, either we or other people train with dummies. So one of these is most likely a dummy chute, just by proxy of like his experience. So I do believe that he jumped out. And the thing is, there's insulation layers he could have been wearing underneath his suit. And again, yes, this was the 70s, but they still had things like dry suits. We still had thermal layers. We still had basic like winter gear that really wouldn't have like bulked you up very much. But even if it did bulk him up, that could also explain why people didn't really recognize any of the people connected to him if he had additional layers on underneath. Secondly, and I did look this up just to be sure I wasn't pulling it out of my ass or anything, but you can actually land parachuting in like simple running shoes or even barefoot if you're experienced.
Really?
There's plenty of videos and plenty of people like on forums and everything who like are showing, like, as long as you know what you're doing and you know how to slow your momentum and you understand how a parachute works, it helps for sure, because there are shoes specifically built for it, but you can do it in basic running shoes or nothing if you really wanted to. And it's especially common with people who land on beaches, which is where some of the money was found. So there is something there too that he could have landed there. But what I honestly think happened is that I think he pulled it off. I think he landed. And if you look at like the area around Tina Bar and the several dozen to hundreds of miles around it, it's not like, people make it sound like it's like middle of nowhere, like it's down the Washougal River and it's like this spot you have to get to by boat. It's next to like 19 suburbs, and like right across the coast on the opposite side of the river is just a series of like camping spots and trailer parks, to where I'm like, to me, it doesn't seem inconceivable that he would have landed somewhere like that, run into a group of people, been like, hey, you didn't see anything. Here's a bag of money. They went and buried it, and then, you know, they either A, forgot about it, or then everything got dredged over, so they weren't able to find it anymore.
Oh, yeah.
But then on top of that, there was a group of kids that did uncover a buried parachute in Washington that was covered by the news and is theorized by the FBI to be Cooper's parachute. So it leads me to believe that he landed, paid somebody off, they buried his chute for him, and he just went back to either Canada or he went back to Mexico or wherever the case may be, where the money wouldn't re-enter circulation.
And he used some other form of payment from his real identity. So do you think he was faking his identity at the airport then?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So it was all, yeah.
I think the Dan Cooper thing being part of like the Canadian bit is where I believe that that's where he went back to. And
makes
that's why
total
I
sense.
Think that he understood like, oh, yeah, that's Tacoma. I've been around here all the time. And if he was, again, military and things were kind of soured at the time that he made all, you know, made all these choices happen, that also lends credence to the idea of why people wouldn't recognize him, or why people would be like, oh, I don't know who that is. That could be anybody. Like, in my opinion, it's not really fantastical. I feel like there are some very obvious explanations that could be there, but I do still recognize that it is still rural Washington. Well, okay, no, take it back. It's not rural Washington. The area around where the money was found is not rural at all. But there is still a possibility that he fucked up, he hit a tree, and that's the end of it. But I just feel like when people poke holes into the idea of like, oh, he couldn't have landed here, or conditions weren't right, I'm like, I don't know, man. People are pretty capable of some pretty amazing things when they're motivated to do something.
Yeah.
And it's just if we're to believe that the accuracy of the stewardesses and whatnot, the guy was cool as a cucumber. Like, he was he was ready to dive out. He was ready to take the risk. And that, to me, just doesn't scream somebody who was kind of like on the inside, like, fuck, this is going to go really bad. Like, it just, to me, sounds like somebody who was like well aware of the fact it could go really bad, but he was very confident it wasn't going to.
Laid back, smoking 8 cigarettes, 2 drinks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like if he was a nervous wreck, he would have like crushed 4 other drinks and gone through like 2 packs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I mean, nothing about his demeanor like screams to me of like a guy who was like like unknowingly going to his death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the fact that he said he didn't need the instructions for the parachutes too tells you he probably did have a lot of experience. I don't know, Tom, you're really swaying me.
I've got two holes though.
Oh, yeah, all right, present the holes. Okay.
The first hole is that with the military chute, mm-hmm. he did specific. That's why they had to redirect and ask the skydiving school, was because he specifically requested a civilian sports chute, and then that he left that one behind.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there is a chance he did that just to like redirect them. But what I was telling them before recording is I think he ended up accidentally taking the military chute because he was so inexperienced that he just saw the larger parachute and thought, this is the one I'm going to take. And then with the kids finding the parachute out in the wilderness, it's not confirmed to be Cooper's. And I believe that one was also a Navy chute.
Yeah. A Navy backpack six with the 26-foot canopy.
Which is what they would have been using. And what I would say to the first hole, though, is that they also fucked up who even gave them the civilian chutes for like 40-plus years of the investigation. And they only just recently found out that they had it wrong the whole time. And now there's like questions about whether or not the guy who gave them the chutes was like in on it, or whether or not he like even knew like what he was giving the chutes away for.
Well, and that's, because it was a very quick redirect.
Yeah.
From the time they contacted McCord, and then Cooper was like, no, I need the civilian chutes. And then they just reached out to this random guy.
Yeah. Totally last minute.
Yeah. I think that is the one hole I can't agree with, but it's also like, it's one of those holes where you're like, there's an equal argument to be made for like, if he was thinking it through, then he would be smart enough to redirect them. But then at the same time, if he wasn't experienced, it would make sense why he fucked it up. And he was like, big, go slower. And they just grabbed that. So,
damn. You guys are really making me think.
I still think he exploded.
I'm still like mainly on that, but I don't know. Tom's got me like 70-30 now.
I like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. It's more fun to think of that.
Yeah.
Well, you guys will have to let us know what you think. Josh, do you have any final thoughts?
I think it was an inside job. DB right. Cooper never existed.
Let's go.
He's just
I love a nice inside job theory.
A legend in our minds, but
forever in our hearts.
Was never there. A, how would they ever be able to confirm any of those pieces are his without DNA evidence at this point? So it'd be basically impossible. So yes, it could be, because I think they also found like a sheet when they're like dredging up in that area as well. And Tina had mentioned that he had wrapped the money in this like white material possibly. So I think it's a bit of a stretch. Maybe is it possible? Sure, but again, there's no way to confirm that. And again, there's Air Force bases up there. There's, you know, I'd be curious to see where they train, you know, where like training stuff happens for the military up in those regions. Is it possible it's just from, you know, other training exercises that have been done up there? I don't know. It'd be crazy to think that the one parachute found, the one little piece of cloth they find, is, it happens to be DB's. But I don't know, the whole Tina Mucklow thing's very interesting to me, the whole theory that maybe she did have some of the money and she's the one actually buried that money there because she was actually at that convent up there for a long time is interesting to me. But who really knows at the end of the day? That's why it's one of the greatest mysteries in American history. It's because we probably will never know. And it seems like the FBI has said, well, if he falls out, you know, if someone stumbles upon his remains one day, we'll call it solved. But until then, we're done wasting time on it. But yeah, let us know your thoughts. What do you think happened to DB Coop? Let us
know. Maybe you guys have a theory we haven't mentioned.
Is there something we haven't talked about? Because, I mean, you could go on and on for days and days and days. I mean, there's so many subreddits that just go on and on and on, and people have all sorts of other theories out there, and or, you know, little tidbits of pieces of information that have surfaced, or bits of you know, supposed evidence to try to explain the unexplainable. But yeah, thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe, follow us, we'd appreciate it. But we'll see you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks to you both for great insight today. Great conversation. Great, I really enjoyed this episode. All right, guys, we'll see you next week. But until then, keep on taking your mind a
mile higher.
Good job.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to the Wealth Break Podcast, a real conversation about finance.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone.
I feel like sometimes being broke is a cycle and that we might have to revisit that.
And we're not stopping at success stories.
What happens when it doesn't go right? How do you cope with it?
Because wealth isn't just about money. It's about creating a life where you thrive and help others do the same.
Listen to the Wealth Break Podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
Hey everyone, this is Carrie Champion, the host of Naked Sports.
The all-new 2025 Nissan Armada Pro4X provides freedom. Freedom to explore, to go wherever you want, with your whole crew and all your toys. With a twin-turbo V6 engine, 8,500 pounds of towing capacity, and seating for eight, this unshakable fortress of a vehicle is built to take you on your next adventure. Drive the all-new 2025 Nissan Armada today. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Intelligent four-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
Having MG can make cooking difficult, but over the years, I've found some really helpful tools and tips that I'm excited to share. Hi, I'm Alicia. I think cooking should always be fun, creative, and of course, delicious. These black bean burgers are hearty, full of flavor, and MG-friendly. You're gonna love them.
Check out Alicia's Black Bean Burger cooking video and other recipes full of tips and tricks for managing common MG symptoms while cooking only at mg-united.com.
Ready? Let's cook.